Yes, yeah, so I'm going to talk about modeling dust emission and the evolution of the galaxy population in the infrared and submillimeter. So the motivations for this kind of work were fairly well described in several talks this morning. This has become clear over the last 3 years or so from various lines of observational evidence that much or most of the star formation in the universe, especially at high redshift, is obscured by dust. So the main lines of argument are observations of the Lyman break galaxies, which are inferred to have quite large extinctions in the ultraviolet, discovery by COBE of a far infrared background with energy density comparable to the optical and UV background, and discovery by SCUBA of a population of faint submillimeter sources, which are usually interpreted as being highly obscure starburst galaxies at redshifts of order 1 or 3. And with that interpretation, that implies these objects contain a lot of star formation at those redshifts. So for all these reasons, it means if you want to understand the star formation history of the universe from the point of view of theoretical models of galaxy formation, you've got to properly model the effects of dust, meaning both absorption of starlight by dust and emission from dust in the infrared and submillimeter. So how do you model dust? Well, here's a sketch of a galaxy. So it turns out to be quite complicated to do it properly because, well, here you are. You have dense clouds and diffuse clouds. You have stars forming out of gas in these dense clouds, and all the stars are more uniformly distributed. As you see, you have a range of large range of dust environments and also large range of heating environments because of the distribution of the stars. So to calculate the dust emission, the ingredients you need are you need to calculate the energy input from the stars, or in principle also from AGNs if there's an AGN in this galaxy. You need a model for the dust grains. You need to calculate rates of transfer of light through the dust distribution. And finally, you need to calculate the heating of the dust grains, calculate the distribution of grain temperatures, and thus the emission from these grains. So the complications in doing this time modeling properly are, as I said, there's the clumping of the dust. You have a wide range of densities and geometries for dust clouds. Also, the clumping of the stars, which depends on the age of the stars and is correlated with the clumping of the dust. As a result of that, dust grains in the same galaxy are exposed to a wide range of the radiation fields. And finally, another thing you have to worry about is that the distribution of dust grain sizes may depend on the metallicity in the galaxy, and also on the environment within a single galaxy. It might depend on the density of the local gas or the intensity of the solar radiation field. So people have followed several different approaches for trying to model the evolution of galaxies in the infrared. So the first approach people started with is a basically very simple phenomenological approach where you start with the observed galaxy population at the present day and you evolve it backwards, assuming some very simple luminosity or density evolution, typically where luminosities or densities of galaxies scale like a power of 1 plus z. And then you just assume that the spectral energy distributions of galaxies at all redshifts are the same as galaxies at the present day. So the second approach. So this approach basically contains no physics of stellar evolution or dust emission. Okay. So the second approach is where you calculate dust luminosities. So you calculate stellar luminosities from theoretical models of stellar population evolution. But for the spectral distribution of the emission from the dust, you use basically observed templates of present-day galaxies. So this approach has been used both with forward evolution models, where you have some semi-analytical model of galaxy formation, or also with these backward evolution models where you start with the present-day galaxy population and evolve things backwards. But as I said, in these models, you calculate the star formation history, and you calculate the stellar luminosity using a population synthesis model. And then typically you have some simple model for how much energy is absorbed by starlight, say from Calvetti model or your SLAD model. That tells you how much energy is absorbed from the stars. But then to calculate how much energy comes out from the dust at different wavelengths, you basically use templates based on observations of present-day galaxies. So in this approach, there isn't any self-consistent calculation of the temperatures of the dust grains. And then the approach which has been developed most recently is to try and do everything in a sort of physically self-consistent way, so using stellar population models to calculate the luminosity from the stars, having a physical model for dust heating, and combining that with a galaxy formation model. So in these models, you have a semi-analytical galaxy formation model telling you how the galaxy population evolves. You calculate luminosity evolution of stars using a population synthesis model. And you have calculate relative transfer of starlight through a clumpy dust distribution. Calculate dust heating, and then you end up predicting. You end up predicting the spectral energy distribution of the dust in the infrared and submillimeter based on this theoretically predicted distribution of dust grain temperatures. So the important point here is it's self-consistent because you're using the same dust grain model and the same dust and star geometry to calculate both the absorption and the emission by the dust. I'll say a bit about dust grain models. So different people have different models, but they're all actually fairly similar. So one has basically two components. There's normal grains, so a mixture of graphite and silicate grains, the power law distribution of sizes. And the larger grains are in thermal equilibrium in the stellar radiation field. So those typically radiate at temperatures of 20 to 40 Kelvin in the diffuse medium, or a few hundred Kelvin in star-forming regions. And these grains dominate the emission in the far infrared. Then the smaller grains are actually out of thermal equilibrium because they have such small heat capacities that absorbing a single photon changes their temperature a lot. And so these can get transiently heated up to 1,000 Kelvin, and so they can produce a lot of emission in the mid-infrared range. And the other component, which are in most present-day models, are these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon molecules, which shape like this. So they're basically large planar molecules made up of carbon in these benzene rings. And these have a range of sizes, so number of carbon atoms in a molecule between, say, 20 and 200. And these molecules, they absorb ultraviolet photons. There are electronic transitions, but then the energy gets dumped into vibrational modes, and then they emit in bands from associated with, well, either carbon-carbon or carbon-hydrogen bonds, and they produce these emission bands at these wavelengths in the mid-infrared. And so these dominate the emission in the mid-infrared, so particularly if you're looking at galaxies in the ISO 15 micron band, for instance, then you have to model these PAH molecules properly. So obviously the important component of these dust models is to know the distribution of sizes for the different types of grains and usually adjust that to fit observations of the local interstellar medium. So this shows an example where the dust grain model has been fit to observations of the extinction in the local interstellar medium. This is the extinction curve. And also at the same time to the emission from the local interstellar medium. So these features here are these bands from these PAH molecules. So I'll say a bit more about the second approach on that list of how you model evolution in the far infrared. So this is the approach of combining a semi-analytical model of galaxy formation with these infrared templates. So this approach was pioneered by Guidoni et al. Basically, you have some semi-analytical model of galaxy formation. In their case, it was simplified in that it had no merging of galaxies or dark matter halos. Solar evolution from population synthesis, and then you calculate the absorption of starlight by dust, assuming a very simple geometry for the stars and dust. So just stars and dust uniformly mixed together in a slab, and that tells you the total far infrared luminosity. But then to calculate the spectral energy distribution for this emission, they use some more empirical approach. So basically, they assume that the dust emission could be split into three different components, PAHs, these thermally fluctuating small grains, and then the larger grains. And these first two components seem to have some fixed spectrum, irrespective of the environment or the galaxy. And the large grain component has a variable temperature, but it's basically just this modified black body distribution. And then the relative proportions of these different components, and also the temperature of these large grain components, are assumed to be a unique function of the total far infrared luminosity of the galaxy. And what's almost to be the same function at all redshifts. That's quite a strong assumption. And then the dependence of those quantities on the far infrared luminosity is obtained by fitting the colors of local galaxies as observed by IRAS. So the limitations of this kind of approach are that basically the dust temperatures are fit to observations rather than being derived theoretically. The approach doesn't really allow for having a wide range of dust temperatures in the same galaxy. It doesn't allow for the scatter in the observed relation between infrared color and luminosity. It doesn't allow for any evolution in this relation. For instance, at high redshift, it might be that you have a higher ratio of infrared luminosity to dust mass, the same total far infrared luminosity, but if the star formation time scale is shorter, you might get this happening. In that case, you'd expect the dust temperature to be larger, but that's not taken account of in this template approach. So the third approach, which is one the group I've been working in has been involved with, is where we try and do everything in a more self-consistent way, so including doing the dust heating in a self-consistent way. So this is described in this preprint by Granato et al. And the people involved are, apart from myself, the group in Durham and a group in Padua. So we have a semi-analytical model of galaxy formation, and that makes a self-consistent prediction for star formation and chemical enrichment histories of galaxies, galaxy sizes, velocity-disk ratios, gas fractions, and so on. And then we'll also predict the rate of galaxy mergers, and mergers are assumed to trigger a starburst. Then the three parameters in the model were adjusted to fit observations of the local galaxy population in the optical and near infrared. And the dust model is basically a fully self-consistent calculation of dust absorption, heating, and emission for a specific geometry and grain model. So the semi-analytical model basically has the usual type of ingredients. So we start from the initial density fluctuations, we calculate merging of dark matter halos, cooling of gas in halos, formation of disks, star formation, feedback from supernovae. We have galaxy merging, producing galaxy spheroids and triggering bursts. We follow the chemical evolution, star populations, and finally the effects of dust. as far as calculating the effects of dust, this is the geometry we assume in the model. So we have stars both in a bulge and a disk. And dust is in two components. There's dust in dense molecular clouds and dust diffusely distributed in a disk. So you have stars forming inside the molecular clouds. They leak out on a timescale of about 10 million years. And then after that, they're just distributed throughout the disk. No, actually, they're inside the same gas layer. We have the same, I mean, all the stars and the diffuse dust seem to have the same scale height here for simplicity. So we run a semi-elliptical galaxy formation model, and then for each galaxy, the model predicts the mass of the disk and bulge and the star formation and chemical enrichment histories for each component, the radius of each component, and we calculate the mass of dust in the galaxy assuming that the dust to metal ratio is constant. So then, since we predict the dust mass and the radius of the galaxy, then the optical depth of the galaxy in dust is then a prediction of the model rather than being fixed observations. And then in the dust model, we calculate the stellar emission, relative transfer of the starlight through the dust, the heating of the dust grains, that tells us the dust temperature at different points in the galaxy, and finally the emission from these dust grains with this whole range of temperature distributions. And so we end up with calculating the galaxy spectrum all the way from the ultraviolet to submillimeter in a consistent way. This shows an example of two examples of spectral energy distributions computed from this dust model and compared to observations of the two local galaxies. So in this case, the galaxy parameters that were fed into the dust model were chosen to try and fit observations of these particular galaxies. So this is, the top one is a nearby spiral galaxy, and the bottom one is a nearby starburst galaxy. So red points are measurements of the spectra of these two galaxies from the ultraviolet all the way to the far infrared, submillimeter. The blue line shows the spectrum you get from the stars alone without dust. And then the black line shows the spectrum including the effect of dust, so both absorption in the UV and emission in the far infrared. So the emission, the dotted line here shows the emission from the diffuse medium, and the dot dashed line shows the emission from the molecular cloud. So you have hotter dust inside the molecular cloud. So the total emission is quite a long way from being a black body. And these are the pH bands. This shows the predictions from the model for the luminosity functions in the blue band and the K band. In these cases, the effects of dust are fairly small. As you see, the model fits this observational data shown by these black points very well. That's not so surprising since we chose the parameters in the semi-analytical model to fit the B band luminosity function at the present day in particular. This shows what the model predicts for the luminosity function in the far infrared at 60 microns. And this is compared with data from IRAS. The blue line is the luminosity function when you include add up the effects of all galaxies, and the green line shows the effects, shows the contribution from recent bursts, where, as I said, the bursts are produced by, in this model, by major mergers of galaxies. As you see, you get a very good fit to the observed luminosity function. At the bright end, you're dominated by these bursts produced by major mergers. This is my next transparency. So we had one parameter to adjust here, which was the time scale in the burst. So it's assumed to scale with the dynamical time in the galaxy. And this shows the effect of varying that ratio. So we could adjust that to fit the luminosity function at the bright end, but the rest of it just came out. this shows the relation between colors in the RS bands and the total fine Fresnel luminosity. So it doesn't match exactly, but we reproduce the general trends pretty well. So as I mentioned at the start, one of the main motivations is to try and understand the star formation history of the universe. And this shows the star formation history that's predicted by models. So in the present version of our model, this is mostly dominated by quiescent star formation. So the bursts produced by major mergers produce only about 10% of the star formation at all redshifts. What's on your phone? Okay. Now you understand? Okay. So the best way to test these predictions for the star formation history are to use the models to predict the luminosity densities at different wavelengths, particularly in the ultraviolet and far infrared, and then compare them directly with measurements. So these shows the predictions for the luminosity densities in different wavelengths. So the purple line here is the far rest frame far UV. The dashed line is without dust, and the solid line is with dust. So we have, the model predicts a large amount of extinction, about a factor of 4 or 5 on average, which actually, this amount of extinction actually varies rather weakly with redshift. Blue line is the B band, red line is K band, the black line is the 60 micron emission. So the far UV and the far infrared both roughly track the star formation, since they're both being powered by young stars, basically. So since the model predicts the luminosity densities at different wavelengths, as a function of redshift, you can calculate the predicted backgrounds at different wavelengths, and this shows the comparison. So the blue lines are the model prediction, the black points and lines are the observational data, which was discussed this morning. So the model fits at most wavelengths pretty well, so from the UV through to the near-infrared, we get the right backgrounds. Also in the submillimeter, beyond about 300 microns, the model agrees very well. There's maybe some deficit in the model around 100 or 200 microns compared to what was observed. So you can also use the model to predict number counts. So this shows 60 micron counts, which agree fairly well, but they only probe to fairly small redshifts. This shows a comparison with the 15 micron counts measured by ISO. So in this case, the model fits at brighter fluxes, but these have some deficit at the fainter fluxes. And this shows a comparison for the submillimeter counts measured by SCUBA. So in this case, the model is deficient by quite a significant factor, a factor of 10 in number counts. But this is in spite of the fact that the model actually predicts the correct total background at 850 microns, also predicts about the right redshift distribution for the sources producing the background. So basically the problem in the model is that the individual sources are too faint, even though the total amount of star formation being predicted seems to agree roughly with what's observed. When we look at the luminosity function in the ultraviolet at redshift 3, we seem to have a similar problem that the predicted luminosity function without dust agrees quite well with the measured luminosity function for line-break galaxies without a dust correction. But when we put dust in, then the luminosity function has galaxies which are typically too faint. So to summarize the diagram so far, so we calculated dust absorption and emission from the same self-consistent model with heuristic geometry for stars and dust, and with the dust content predicted by the model. So the model agrees very well at low redshift, all the way from the ultraviolet through to the far infrared. And at higher redshifts, it produces the correct UV luminosity density and about the correct typical extinctions in the UV. Also reproduces the intensity and redshift distribution for the submillimeter background. But at higher redshifts, the luminosities of the individual galaxies seem to be too low. Basically, we need to modify the star formation prescription or the prescription for producing bursts in the model so that more of the star formation happens in very bright objects. Okay, and I'll finish there.
So on this last point about the far infrared background,
yeah.
If you make the individual sources brighter to meet the SCUBA counts, presumably you make the integrated background brighter too. So somehow you have to make the sources brighter but less numerous. Can you comment on that?
The idea is to make the sources have the same total amount of star formation at higher redshift, but reorganize it so it's happening in objects with larger individual star formation rates. Okay. It's true, you don't want to multiply the luminosity of every source by some factor because then you'd overproduce the background. That's right. Yeah.
So,
right. Well, the gas content depends on cooling and feedback and things like that, right? Sure, provided you're consuming all the gas that falls in and turning it into stars on a short time scale, then you'll get the same average star formation rate at higher redshifts. Yeah. Well, it's a bit different because I think in your model, you didn't produce a submillimeter background in your quiescent star formation model, right? Whereas we produce a submillimeter background, that's spot on. So where we need the ULOGs or something to produce the SCUBA NUM accounts. But in your model also your ULOGs had a different mass function, right? Different initial mass function for the stars.
Well, with the assumption that they were so obscure that it was very little
But if you change the initial mass function a lot from what we have in the present model, then you'd overproduce the total background.
I'm trying to, there are many details and it's often hard not to be able to, rather easy not to be able to tell which detail matters most. But it seems to me that one self-consistency, which I'm not sure is in the models, is that the amount of star formation leads to the amount of dust formation.
That is included because we calculate the chemical evolution in our galaxies based on the amount of star formation and the gas content. The metallicities of the galaxies evolve in a self-consistent way. We just assume that a constant fraction of the metals in the gas phase go into dust.
And is there any time delay put in between the star formation and the dust formation?
No, the chemical evolution is instantaneous recycling.
But is that realistic? If we thought that the dust came out of stars that were longer lived than the burst?
Well, I think the preferred models have dust coming out of stars with ages up to a few hundred million years. So provided you're not going to very high redshift, I think that's not a major worry.
Okay.
What fraction of the baryons end up in the galaxies, and how do you decide, how much to put in when?
Well, we don't decide how many bangs to put in the galaxies, and that's a result of calculating the cooling of gas in halos and allowing for feedback effects.
Well, how much gas do you put in the halos?
This model assumes we have omega baryons of 2%, okay, and the fraction of omega that ends up in galaxies in other stars of cold gas is about 1/10 of that. So most of the baryons are still in the hot phase in these models.
Well, so you put in the amount that's required to get the stars.
It would seem to be a natural to use the semi-analytic methods to try and deal with merging entities in terms of black hole feeding, et cetera. I haven't seen that actually being done. I'm surprised you didn't try and do it, given that you have this discrepancy with the sources. Has anybody done this with semi-analytic modeling?
Well, I mean, Guinevere and Martin Haynault did a...
Does it give you something that would...
quasar evolution in semiotic models, but...
Does it give enough that would plausibly give rise to these sources, given what we heard about the nature of them this morning? Okay, we need to move on to the next talk. We can have more questions and discussion.